Today I want to talk about souls, spiritual growth, journeys, destination, ambition, inertia, comfort and convenience versus challenge, images, and hope, all in about 35 minutes. What if this lifetime was part of the journey of your soul? And the journey is longer than one lifetime. Would you see things differently? What if our bodies are vehicles, our minds are like the drivers of the vehicles, and our soul is the very patient passenger who knows that, you know what, eventually, in some lifetime, we will progress to full spiritual understanding. But the journey is a journey. A journey is not the destination. It's easy to fall into that trap that we're not going to enjoy the trip until we get to the destination, at which point we make a judgment whether we enjoyed the trip or not, whether it was worthwhile. We disadvantage ourselves that way. As we experience more joy on the journey, the more we fulfill the purpose of our soul, which is joy. Joy is, you know, it's not a place. It doesn't have a longitude, doesn't have a latitude. It's a vibrational state. And the fact is, joy is an achievable vibrational state regardless of our longitude and latitude of our physical body. We don't have to be any space or place or time in order to experience that vibration. We can access that energy anywhere, anytime on our journey. As we stand in or sit in any place on the earth, it's pretty much easy for us to imagine ourselves as separate. You know, we're individual and we're separate from everything else. On a physical level, maybe that's true to a large extent. My left arm is my left arm. It's not your left arm. And as far as we can tell, it's nobody else's, not yours, not anybody's left arm. And my left arm is not my chair or my computer. However, we may be physically more connected than meets the eye. This was interesting. Years ago, I read this article. Somebody analyzed the movement of air on planet Earth and with all kinds of mathematical computations. And the scientist that wrote the article came to the conclusion that each of us has definitely inhaled and exhaled molecules of air that Jesus would have breathed when he was on Earth 2,000 years ago. It's like, whoa, really? Really? If we're breathing somebody else's breath, we might not be as physically separate as from other people as we may think. When you look at life, we can pretty much predict the physical journey of our physical lives. We know that we start physically when a sperm from our father and our ovum from our mothers connect in conception. We know that our bodies are going to grow over a period of, say, about 9 months within our mother's wombs. There's no mystery there. We understand that now, that pattern. We know that our bodies are going to emerge from our mothers at the end of that period of time. We know once we emerge that we can't feed ourselves, we can't walk, we can't talk. There are a lot of things that physically we're not able to do having just been born. We can understand, now starting at that starting point of conception, that physical growth in our abilities is going to continue. At some point, we're going to be able to eat solid food. At some point, we're going to be able to stand up. We're going to walk. We're going to run. We're going to be able to tie our own shoes. We're going to be toilet trained. We're going to be able to dress ourselves. And it goes on and on as we develop a lot of these skills and experiences physically. The more we learn about all these different things, how to feed ourselves, how to cut our food, how to drink a glass of milk without spilling it, all this stuff. The more we learn of those things, the more confidence we're going to have on our journey. It would be nice if somebody deliberately said, you know what, I want to help you learn how to use your hands, how to use your feet, how to use your body. So that knowledge is, since you're going to be in this vehicle for a long time, 120 years by my count, it makes sense that you would want to have this knowledge. We have a predictable emotional development pattern, too. I think it's pretty easy to recognize that we're going to have the same emotions that our mother had when she was carrying us. If she experienced something, we experienced something because we were the same as her. In that time in utero, she's providing our first emotional inputs. Her feelings about her pregnancy is converted by us into being how she felt about us, which may not necessarily be true. Could be totally different. In the summertime, I hear this story from pregnant women. It's prickly heat. It's uncomfortable to be pregnant during the summertime. Well, being uncomfortable due to the pregnancy is not the same thing as being uncomfortable with the baby. But we could interpret it to mean that. We can take that discomfort as she's uncomfortable with me. She doesn't like me. She doesn't want me. I cause a problem. All of that stuff can go on, and it's not necessarily accurate. Christ says in Christ Returns, reveals startling truth, that being born involves feelings of abandonment, insecurity, and loss of privacy. Imagine, we start life emotionally with about 9 months of our mother's emotion, all the emotions from her, from our fathers, from the delivery room staff, from whomever she was around during that nine-month period. We are starting life with the emotions during the birth process from our mothers, as well as the delivery room staff, that they've got anxiety. That's how we're starting life, being anxious. And then, if we add in abandonment, insecurity, and loss of privacy, it's like, wow. It's not surprising that we may be starting life, I'll say, behind in an emotional eight ball. Like, wow. Whew. And then, when we're home, we find ourselves in a sea of emotions of our family. Right? All the responsibilities that come with having a new baby at home, siblings and parents, and trying to manage the physical and emotional needs of this infant while at the same time doing whatever they need to do in order to keep the family whole, earning a living, keeping the roof over the head, and preparing food and shopping and doing laundry and about a million other things. It's like, whoo. So now we're in this sea of emotions at home. What's included in that? How about jealousy, stress, fear, anxieties, hopes, dreams, aspirations, gratification? A lot of different things are swirling around us. You know this. Events with emotions attached to them become imprinted on us. They're more memorable. They make an impact. And only we, as individuals, know which ones impact us. I had these conversations with my three children some years back, saying I thought if they would sit down with me and we could go over their traumatic experiences and they could talk about them with me, they would be benefited. So they consented one by one. And I told them what I thought were the 10 most traumatic things that I had caused for them. In each case, none of the children remembered anything I was talking about. I don't remember that. I don't remember that. I don't remember that. I don't remember that. And they said, well, now that you bring up the subject, Dad, let me tell you about how you traumatized me. And they went through 10 things. In every case, all 30 things. Like, I don't remember that. I don't remember that. So what I thought were traumatic and imprinting on them seemed not to be. What was traumatic and imprinting on them, I didn't recognize as having occurred at all. Individually, we need to determine which imprints imprinted us, and that's not something a third party can easily do or an outsider can do. On the one hand, our consciousness shapes us. That's why we're born as human beings. We're not born as oak trees. We're not born as Australian sheepdogs. We're born as human beings. That consciousness is contained in the sperm and the ovum. And the result of that conception seems pretty obvious. But on the other hand, all these physical and emotional inputs, the ones that occur during conception, in that 9-month period at birth, particularly in regard to our own identity, you know, this is about us, this is about us, which as little humans, we interpret a lot of incoming environmental signals to be about us. Maybe that we are the center of the universe, so everything is about us. And those inputs, those things that are delivered to us, indicate to us what we can do and what we can't do, what we can be and what we can't be, what we can have and what we can't have, and the parameters or the limitations of what our life will be like. On a mental level, our thoughts spur our emotions, and our thinking about ourselves kind of leads to our feelings about ourselves. However, let me give you an opposing point of view. Some people believe that feelings come before the thoughts. And so we have a feeling, and then we have a thought about it. We try to put words to it. We try to create an understanding of that in order to clarify it and make it more useful to us. So I've often wondered about that, actually for years. So is this the sequence of creation? I'll give you two of them. The first one is this. First of all, we have the spiritual unseen level. And then using mental activity, thinking, we shape that energy, that consciousness, and it triggers emotional activity in us. And then things become physically manifested. The second form is this possibility. From the unseen spiritual level, the next thing we notice is a feeling. It is a perception, pre-words perhaps, pre-thought. So we have emotional activity to include intuition or clairvoyance or claircognizance or clairaudience. And then we start to think about it. We have mental activity about the feelings, whatever just came to us. We start thinking about it. And the object of that signal. And then we deal with it more and more, and then it physically manifests, either in terms of our activities or something we create. I wonder, do thoughts precede emotions, or do emotions precede thought? Or do they both happen just different times? Seems obvious to me, though, in our culture, there's emphasis on thinking, on the mind, and on the physical brain. So it's no wonder that we accept that first version, that thinking precedes feeling. The mental comes before the emotional. But I wonder if it's true. Back to our journey. In our mental journey, lots of inputs are provided to, quotes, educate us, to train us. I see people that like to train animals, train dogs to do certain tricks and so on. It's like, sounds like education. Sounds like a lot of our memorization that goes on in school. We don't do thinking so much. We do memorization. We are trained. Oh, I'm going to train this group of 20 or 30 kids to put the answers in the right box on the test paper. Have them check the correct true or false. Have them check the first correct letter for the multiple choice. I'm not sure that's education so much as training. We learn how, though, in that process, how to count, how to speak, how to recite the alphabet, learn etiquette and manners, maybe, you know, that's how you hold a fork and sit up straight and elbows off the table. We learn how to be a man. We learn how to be a woman. We learn how to be in relationships. We learn how to care for one another. A lot of our learning, maybe the great, great majority of our learning, comes to us through images. Images of the numbers of the multiplication tables. Didn't we look at that? 1 times 1, 1 times 2, 1 times 3. Didn't we look at images, representations on pieces of paper as we were learning the multiplication tables? Didn't we look at the alphabet, A, B, C? Didn't we, as we try to learn it? Didn't we see words on a piece of paper? See, Dick, run. See, Jane, shows my age, and so on. And then words combined with pictures. Picture of a chicken with the word chicken underneath it, cow with the word cow underneath it, and on and on. These things are common in lots of different languages. Words combined with relevant pictures. There's an old adage that says, our children will do what we do, not what we say. I believe this idea emphasizes that images of our behaviors are more influential to our children than the words we speak, which they recognize are often just noises we're making with our mouths. Don't do this and don't do that and you must do this and you must do that. But they'll notice our behavior. Because images can be visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and I even think that smells and tastes have versions of these kinesthetic images that can be easily recalled, brought back into our awareness. When I was 16 years old, a friend and I had a bottle of gin, a pint of gin, and we were walking and we were drinking straight gin from the bottle. I got sick. Not too long after that episode, I smelled gin one more time, and my whole body shuddered. I have avoided the smell of gin ever since that evening. I've been, it's like, oh, no. Won't get anywhere near it. But I know drinking was a habit pattern of my father. He drank. Other men drank. I had that image. My mother smoked Camel cigarettes. She smoked until she died at 76 years old. My father also smoked, but he smoked intermittently. Sometimes he would smoke, and then it seemed like he would go weeks or months not smoking. Then he would smoke, and then he would not smoke. When I was about 10 years old, my mother found a pack of cigarettes in my pocket. They were partially empty pack, so it wasn't a brand new, unopened pack. She sat me down at the kitchen table and lectured me about the dangers of smoking, my age, what it could do, blah, 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 all that stuff. When she was done, I looked at her and said, can I have my cigarettes back now? She got up. And a couple of minutes later, my father came into the kitchen, sat down, and he added to my mother's lecture, and then he left. My mother returned. I asked, can I have my cigarettes now? She said, with a little bit of intensity, no, and then walked away. So, imagine that. I was doing what my parents were doing. I was doing what the advertising said men did, what cool guys did, what rebels did. That's why I did it. I have another image. I wish I could draw this image, and I wish I could animate it. I can see a developing fetus ingesting images. So this picture of images going into this fetus, and it's growing, and it's growing, and it's growing. And I see a baby about to be born, and the images are going into this baby, all kinds of images. Then the infant is now taking in images from the environment and through its mouth and through its physical contact with other people. It's taking in these images. And a baby in a crib is taking in images of her or his surroundings, just pulling in these images into the body. The child out of the crib is taking in images about herself through her eyes, through her ears, through her body. And by the images being deliberately directed to us by parents, by siblings, by our teachers, by our peers, by our ministers, people are delivering these images into us, and we're taking them in. We're like Pac-Man, eating these images, and our bodies are getting more mature physically. We're like a Lego creation. All these assembled pieces of Legos, except with the images of ourselves, others, life, God, people, opportunity, what's possible, what the future could be, what we can be, do, and have, don't physically exist until we take them in. Boom. And it becomes part of us. So unlike Lego constructions, or when I was a kid, I used Lincoln Logs, those things are easy to dissemble. We can take those apart and put them back together, take them apart, put them back together. No big deal. Of course, what we can create with them are somewhat limited. But adjusting the identity that we've assembled over the course of our life, starting at conception, and all the images added to this one being that you and I are now, it's like, adjusting those images can be a little bit more difficult. Some people think that we can even have images that, almost like a fail-safe, that prevent us from adjusting our images. You can never change this. You can never amount to anything. You can never do anything about this. Boom. Now, if we bump into that guard dog of an image, boom, boom, boom. I can't do anything about this. This is my lot in life. There's nothing I can do. I can't change my life for the better. I can't be healthier or happier or more successful or more giving or more contributory. It's because I can't get to it. That image has to be dealt with, because that image can sabotage our growth. If we try to improve, can't do it. Can't do it. Can't do it. It's like that switch to spur our growth is off limits to us. The other night, a Thursday night Q&A call, a couple of women asked about the topic of men who will not work. A father of six and I think a father of two would not go to work, will not go to work. Thought about it after the call. And Marianne suggested maybe the idea is ambition. So that night and the next morning we talked about that. Ambition. They seem to lack ambition. So I looked up ambition, thefreedictionary.com. And then I started to think, wait a second. I flashed back a couple of days prior to the Thursday night call. I had read an article about a woman, a very high-achieving, what I call an ambitious woman, Mae Jemison. She wanted to go into outer space when she was a little child. She had that idea. She wanted to go into outer space. And she later wanted to be a doctor. She became a medical doctor, and she applied to NASA. And the second time she applied, she was accepted. She ended up going into outer space. She had images images as a young girl, images of going into space, images of being a doctor. She had images of being a dancer, and she's a dancer as well. Her parents gave her images. They encouraged her to have images, to acquire her own images, the ones that she could relate to. They didn't clamp them down. They opened up the door to images, or the ceiling to images. She went to college as a 16-year-old to Stanford. That's saying something. It's like, wow, You can probably appreciate that images can be like the blueprints that you and I are going to follow to create our lives. That's what Mae Jemison did. It's what you do. It's what I do. I think it's what we all do. Those images are the blueprints, and our lives are going to unfold according to our set of images, an enormous set of images. Wouldn't it have been nice when we were little children if our parents knowingly recognized that, you know what I'm doing? We're going to provide experiences that give you images that will empower you, that will help you grow, to make you more confident, to make you happier, healthier, more successful. It's like, And while we're at it, we'll make sure these images contribute to your sense of worthiness, your goodness. How about your ability to learn, your ability to love and be loved? How about we'll give you images of cooperation, what that looks like. You'll see images of lack of cooperation, and then you'll be able to do a comparison and choose what you want. How about persistence? You have images of persistence. If it doesn't happen the first time you try, you have images that say, try and try again. Try and try again without getting misemotional. That would be a fantastic set of images. And images of trial and errors being absolutely necessary to our growth. Wouldn't that be fantastic if our parents did that and helped us understand and gain images of achieving what we want and give us images of those times when we were going to fail to get what we wanted and how to react and how to respond and what to do next? That would be fantastic if we developed that set of images for our lives. Within the consciousness of all living things is the image, the blueprint, of what we can become. A rose bush has in its consciousness this image of a rose bush in one form or another. Something vibrationally is there. So, guess what? The rose bush is, it's growing like a rose bush. Yeah. And it produces roses. We can only be human beings. The main difference between us and a rose bush is that we have a greater range to our becoming. What we can become on our journey is way wider, way longer, way more interesting than what a rose bush can do. We've got a greater range of mobility, right? Rose bush, you don't see one of them walking down the street. You might see roses being delivered to a house after they've been cut, but generally speaking, we have way more mobility. We have way more expression, actions, causativeness, mental, emotional, and physical activities that we can engage in. We can choose from an amazing assortment of images of what we want to grow into, what we want to express on our journey. We can be as beautiful and attractive as a rose, or we can be like the thorn on the stem, and many others. I wonder if a lack of ambition is mainly due to the inaccessibility of an image of what a person could be, do, and have. If they can't find the image other than what they're currently doing or not doing, is that what causes a lack of ambition, that inaccessibility? I think it's real exciting that we can remove images that prevent access to that. We can go back and rehabilitate those kind of desires from childhood, those images that were planted in the soil and then covered up probably by other negative inputs, by cruelty perhaps, by abuse, by being demeaned or denigrated. But we can go back and access the power of those passions, those talents, those ambitions. And even this, even if we grew up in harsh soil where those images weren't provided to us, didn't exist, we can go and collect our own right now. We can add images to our consciousness that empower us so that we can rearrange the blueprint and make it be something more spectacular than it currently is. Christ, in the Christ letters, constantly refers to humanity's desire for comfort and convenience and gratification of desires. If those desires inspire us to accept the challenge and then grow on every level so we can fulfill them, that sounds ambitious and like a good thing. But if that desire for comfort is such a powerful image that it prevents us from getting off the couch, I think that would be a problem. If we need to seek an image to inspire us, our growth, our ambition, I'm thinking that using the framework that Christ talks about in letter number one, where he describes what divine consciousness is doing for all of its creations, providing growth on every level, nutrition and nourishment on every level, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, with rhythm, all within the system of spiritual law and order, law of cause and effect, a.k.a. we reap what we sow. If that's important to divine consciousness, I think it should be important to us. And if divine consciousness is working for us, in us, and through us, we will want to find or create images of those activities where we use our passions and our talents in alignment with those natural energy flows in which the divine is trying to provide those things for its creations. We get in that stream of consciousness and we'll be carried to it. We can find images that support us. Support our spiritual body, our mental body, our physical body, our emotional body, so that all four bodies are in vibrational alignment. When we have those images, and I think we need to go on a high vibration image diet with our thinking, with our feeling, with our listening, with our reading, with our meditating, with our praying, then we'll have those images in our consciousness, and the blueprint of our life will be shifted to a better place. And I think, frankly, the heights of our achievement can be far greater than anything we've ever considered up to this point. But it's about a high vibration image diet. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 of Christ Returns. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. I'm guessing there were about 15 words right there. And if we converted those into images, we would be making a huge difference in our lives. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.